You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spine number 77, 1962's Ride the High Country, and the violent ouvrage of Bloody Sam Peckinpah, featuring old guns, young bucks, whores, Mexicans, messy squibs, messy men, gallons of liquor, brainy cucks, big old trucks, sweaty thugs, ninjas, Soviet conspiracies, and Warren Oates. Martin.
Yes.
All I want to do is enter my house justified.
Take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark to see. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, we're going to do the filmography of Bloody Sam Peckinpah tonight, which I think it's fair to say is one of the weird unifiers in our filmic taste that we really haven't covered yet.
Yeah, I think that we were talking earlier before getting our weekly chicken wings at Frazier's, delicious here in Austin, Texas. So we were talking about how he's kind of someone that I will just forget about. I'm just like, well, this is like an old standard for me because there was an era, specifically end of college and then right before grad school, where I was just like continuing my dive into like new Hollywood filmmaking and reading like Easy Rider's Raging Bulls. And Peckinpah's is really interesting part of that era, but also like kind of similar to the way we love Walter Hill, that these extreme masculine, but with a real kind of worldview to them.
Well, and also they worked with a lot of the same type of actors, James Coburn,
hard men
who seem like they came from a different era, with like Walter Hill working not only with Coburn, but also with like Charles Bronson and Hard Times, where like a guy who literally like before he became an actor was like a Western Pennsylvania coal miner.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
and that's who Sam Peckinpah was at his core too, is that like even though he was born in the Valley in California, like he was a descendant from this family that moved from Indiana on like an oxen train to the western side of the United States. And his like grandfather or great grandfather was like a logger for like 26 years. And they had like an entire mountain that was named after them called like Peckinpah Ridge or something, because he was the main guy who like worked up there. So like they were real salt of the earth, blue collar, like callus on your hands, like working types. And like that's where Peckinpah comes from. And like when you watch his movies, in the same way that you kind of watch like Charles Bronson's movies, especially like the early ones, like they were reflective of like a certain personality that came from a different era.
Yeah. And there's a work ethic to it, but also like a very like a danger to a lot of this stuff too. I mean, one of the things that you hear about, we don't have to get into it this very moment, but like, you know, Peckinpah was difficult to work with. You had these directors, these actors,
to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, severe alcoholic, and you know,
also like his legacy is defined almost as much by the movies he wasn't allowed to finish or were taken away from him as they were from like the actual masterpieces he was allowed to complete.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, we you know, I chose this one today, and as we
Ride the High Country from 1962.
And what's interesting is that I saw this very late. I had seen all of Peckinpah's stuff before that. And I was, when I was at Emory for grad school, I had a professor. He would just come to class sometimes, like, hey, I'm trying to get rid of some old discs from my collection. And like, I had this burned copy of Ride the High Country. And I was like, what the hell is that? I mean, I heard of it, but I was like, I'd seen it. And he's like, you want it? I'm like, yep.
Sure.
But I just burned a copy and I bring it home and I'm just absolutely blown away because, you know, something we talk a lot about on this podcast and we both agree on is a sense of sometimes watching an earlier film or a later film of a filmmaker as kind of like a Rosetta Stone to like the rest of their career. And you watch this film, and while it is a lot tamer in terms of violence, stylistically does not have that sepia tone that kind of dominated a lot of his films in the late 60s and into the 70s. This looks like an early 60s, you know, production, but
it's a much stagier Western.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the same time, it's a Sam Peckinpah movie.
Oh yeah.
To
its core.
But thematically across the board, it's all there. But it's also, we actually brought this film up when we did one of my favorite episodes was the Bud Bedeker episode and how this seems to be like, you know, a bridge film. You know, you have...
Very much so.
And it's not quite into the revisionist Western era, but you have the theme of these old guns who are... For one of my favorite scenes Peckinpah's ever done is the one of the opening scenes of Ride the High Country. And I remember, actually, I love this film so much that I was TA for a Western class that I've mentioned before when I was in grad school with Dr. David Pratt, and we just watched the best stuff. And he goes, hey, do you want to do this? Do you want to teach the Peckinpah week? I said, absolutely. Like, this is why I'm here. And I already knew I wasn't getting my PhD, but I was like, well, I can talk about Peckinpah all day and have no trouble. But I kind of opened with Ride the High Country. So I said, you know, this is, you know, planting the seeds for a lot of stuff that comes up. Specifically, I think, you know, in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and in Wild Bunch, which is the end of the West. It's that era of the late 1800s, even the types of guns they have, like in the Wild Bunch with, you know, they have Colt 45 1911s. They have pump shotguns, which are later in the 1800s as well. But you have the sense of there's no room for you anymore. Oh, the old gun, right? And you have Joel McRae walking into this kind of this bustling city to take his first job in a while close to what he wants to do, which is more of a lawman, his past. And he walks in, and people are screaming at him, and he thinks they're welcoming
him. Get out of the old
but,
the way,
but
old
at
man.
First he thinks they're welcoming him. Like, it's like, it almost feels like a very oaky Western, like, hey, welcome to town, mister. And it's not that. It's, hey, get the fuck out of the way. And he almost gets hit by a camel, and then he doesn't still quite get it, and a cop says, can't you see you're in the way?
Yeah.
Pulls him out of the way and almost gets hit by a car. So you're thrust into the sense of it's a Western, but the days are numbered for men.
The
like
modern
this.
Age is encroaching
exactly
on like these old, you know, cow busters kind of like walking through or riding through the countryside.
Yeah. Just gunmen, you know? Yeah.
Which, I mean, is a perfect kind of metaphor for where Peckinpah's career was at the time, because he was a guy who really came up making TV for stuff like The Rifleman, The Westerner. He, I believe, did like an uncredited like screenplay pass on One Eyed Jacks with like Marlon Brando.
As did everybody. Yeah.
As did everybody else. But also, like, you know, he makes The Deadly Companions, which is like, I believe, his feature debut. And it's a much, again, kind of old-timey, stagier Western in the vein of being kind of like an episode of, like, The Rifleman, just put it at feature length, you know. And, like, the thing about Ride the High Country is that it almost feels like a spiritual precursor mostly to like the Wild Bunch.
100%.
Because it's about, you know, old friends and old foes coming together, doing a job that like secures their future so that they more or less can retire going forward, a bunch of double crosses, and also just like a bunch of guys who live by very masculine, dusty codes, you know, and honor, like how they navigate their life. And that it's about honorable men existing inside of a landscape that might be coming more morally hazy.
Yeah, because I agree. I love it because we're talking about the encroaching of civilization of like the modern era, right? On the Western in late 1800s, or moving into a time when these men are no longer wanted or needed, right? Because you have obviously with the railroad and then the car, you're not going to have the same. The mission of this film is to, you know, take money from gold sales, or actually take, you know, down to basically, you know, 50 miles between a mining camp and where the bank is. And there's that moment where the banker says, he's like, you know, the age of the gunman has passed, the age of the sensible, the sensible businessman has arrived. Right. And so it is this, like, you know, we now are the ones running this country and we don't need the tough man anymore. But I've always found fascinating about Peckinpah, though, you see it in Ride the High Country, and I agree, it links the best to Wild Bunch, as like you said, kind of like a proto Wild Bunch, is you strip away, you know, all of the codes men believe in, and in the end, all it is about friendship. You know? Because for me, the end of this and the end of Wild Bunch are so similar, where everything else is gone. Everything else that their era is gone. A lot of their friends are dead. They're going to die. But it says, it's like, well, I'll walk out with a friend.
Right.
You know, for one last hurrah.
When you watch, because I rewatched The Wild Bunch to prepare for this episode too, is that like, if you boil down The Wild Bunch to its core, as much as it is like a men on a mission type movie just set in the old West and about these old kind of cowboys facing the end of their era too, I mean, that movie is really about William Holden and Ernest Borgnine being best friends who are basically like ride or dies for each other for like the rest of their lives, until basically they all die in the infamous shootout at the end.
Yeah, when you link it again to, you have the Robert Ryan character who is an old friend, right?
Right.
And
who becomes an adversary, which is like a Peckinpah trope that he'll do time and again.
Because it's, you know, it's the thing that I believe you and I both read Western books, and I think we're both equally obsessed with the Western, is that it was a thing where a lot of times outlaws would be, you know, hired to be lawmen, because it's like, well, you know how to, you're a dangerous man with a gun. Do you want to be marshal? You know, and that was, it happened a lot. And you have that with Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, is that, you know, Pat Garrett, Billy Kidd were in the same gang.
Right.
And kind of,
which I mean is the same as kind of like the Wild Bunch, because it was about two criminal associates.
Yeah.
With the William Holden, Robert Ryan characters together, who one is basically given the chance to essentially hunt down the other, or he goes back to jail.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like, I know that it's honestly a very similar setup to The Proposition, which we talked about last week, but that's a very Peckinpah movie. I mean,
right down to the dust and the mud and everything.
It just happens to be in Australia, but it's the same thing of like, hey, and these are you get it from the beginning of Wild Bunch, evil men, you know, I mean, like by a black and white evil, there's a standard, but there's a gray area that I think is opened up by Peckinpah, you know, where you don't have the black hat and the white hat.
No
thing anymore.
They're all gray.
They're all gray. And a lot of characters.
Well, I mean, right up to the opening line of the Wild Bunch of, if they move, kill them.
Yeah.
Like it's literally,
and civilians,
this gang of criminals taking civilians hostage so that they can pull off this heist and escape, all the while they're being set up by the Robert Ryan character and his gang to basically be massacred the entire time while they hold up this bank. But it's like, you know, one of the things that's incredible about one of the numerous things,
1 billion things
say about the Wild Bunch, a movie that's been analyzed throughout our film culture and history now as much as like a Casablanca, you know, is that,
and deservedly
like,
so.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you, it's one of those movies that you literally, like, I turned it on yesterday and got on the couch like middle of the afternoon on like a Sunday, and like 20 minutes in, you're like, oh yeah, that's right. This is what movies are supposed to feel like, you know? And I'm like streaming it off of like a Plex server on like a small, like 30-inch TV. And it's still so transportive and violent and incredible and stylistic. Like those opening freeze frames.
Get out of town.
That he would also like replicate for like The Getaway, that like stutter step, like introduction stuff that he does. It's just like, you watch it and you're like, nobody. It's one of those things. It's kind of like what we talk about watching like something like Halloween or whatever, is that like when, or Jaws or stuff, is that like when those movies came out, The Exorcist, stuff like that, is that like nobody had ever seen anything like this before. But like Peckinpah was so ahead of the curve and so stylistically like inclined that you watch it now, what, almost 50 years later?
Oh, no. 69
years later.
So 56 years.
56 years after The Wild Bunch initially came out. It still feels like, if you release that movie in theaters today, not to sound like Quentin Tarantino or anything, but like you would blow people's minds. If you stole that like opening sequence with all the freeze frames and the title cards for the actors' names and everything, like people would be like, dude, did you see that fucking movie with that intro? That's insane. Because like, it's just, it's timeless. Like he knew a way to shoot and cut a movie that like still like echoes throughout like cinematic history.
No, and I was doing the same thing. I hadn't watched it in years, but it used to be like probably twice a year. I was, I had an era of just like all I wanted to do was watch, again, new Hollywood stuff. And that was one of the films I would, I had the Warner Brothers snap case or the fold-over plastic early DVD.
I think the last time I'd watched it was during one of the fabled summers where the Ritz, as we've talked about time and time again here, would roll out 70 millimeter prints of classics like that and Lawrence of Arabia and 2001 and stuff. I think the last time I'd seen it before I revisited this time was when I watched it in 70 millimeter at the Ritz. And again, it's just one of those movies where you're like, Jesus fucking Christ, like seeing this projected this way is like mind blowing.
Well, it's, one of the reasons, and I, again, with this, we're kind of moving back to like single movie episodes a little bit, you know, but one of my favorite movies and one of my favorite first time viewing experiences is Ride the High Country. Cause I was like, oh, this is the guy. It's so stylistically, it looks so different from Peckinpah. But again, as you watch it, you're like, oh, he's got something on his mind. It's all, again, it's all there.
It's the epitome of almost like a Trojan horse movie, to where it's like, it's very clearly a guy making like a job for hire for MGM, for the studio, but like using it as a way to smuggle in all of his stylistic and kind of thematic interests before they're even like fully developed, and he's allowed to do it in a very auteurist way with like Wild Bunch, Pat Garrett, and Billy the Kid. I mean, even Major Dundee, if you watch a movie that was infamously like taken away from him, if you watch the extended cut of Major Dundee, it's very much, you're like, oh shit, that this is almost like one of the ultimate Peckinpah movies.
Well, and agreed, and with like, you know, with Ride the High Country, watching it, this is 1962. And holy shit, the undercurrent of sexual violence running through a good 30, 40 minutes of the
movie.
And
also forgiven sexual violence.
Right, well, because you have, first of all, the hero who basically assaults her, but then everything with the Hammond clan.
Oh, boy. These,
you know, but you have, like, Warren Oates, you have the guy from, the car salesman from Psycho, you have L.Q. Jones.
L.Q. Jones, one of the recurring Sam Peckinpah stock players.
He shows up like Souther Martin as well in a lot of his stuff, and
also the director of A Boy and His Dog, the Don Johnson post-apocalyptic
LQ movie. Jones did that?
Yeah, he made that movie.
Oh, okay. But I did not know that. But he there's, at once they reach, there's this, you know, the Hammond clan mining camp, there's this, it's mostly honestly because of Warren Oates, but these guys are all leering at Elsa, this It's a little bit context for the listeners that
who's like proto what's her name? Julianne Nicholson.
Yes. Yeah. And they that's true. No, they brought her. Like, she's like, hey, I'm going with you on your mission. I want to go to Course Gold to base the guy who proposed to me. Yeah. And she's just
She's escaping the preacher father and R.G. Armstrong and everything.
Yeah, and he's this like totalitarian Christian, and she's like stuck. She's basically stuck on this farm, and she gets there, and it becomes clear to the audience very quickly of, and they even mention the first couple of minutes. They're like, kind of reminds us of our cousin's wedding where we all had a go at the bride, and it becomes clear it's like, oh, these guys are all going to have their way with Elsa, who's this very innocent woman, and it continues to this one of Peckinpah, again, he really, like you said, he's kind of sneaking it in there. There's this whole scene at basically, it's a brothel. And
they're one of many Peckinpah like scenes at a brothel.
But this one has this huge, busty madam, who runs this place. And it's this garish scene of a wedding there. And Peckinpah does these wide angle shots of like laughing drunk people and also looking around and being like, oh shit, like I made a mistake. And I think, again, it's a common theme of Peckinpah's disillusionment or the loss of romanticism, right? Because as an audience member, you're seeing what is like, you know, love and all these things, constructs that we look up to. But underneath it all, there's not much there.
Yes and no. I agree with you, but I also think there's an added layer to where, like, this is a strange comparison, but hear me out. It's like when you watch the early Paul Thomas Anderson movies, they're clearly movies made about cocaine and people on cocaine by somebody who was doing cocaine, heavy amounts of cocaine at the same time. Like, to me, a lot of Peckinpah's attitudes on screen about booze and the way men imbibe and also interact with not only each other but with women while they're drinking is very much taken from his own life. Like, this is like about a guy who, like, you know, if I watched a documentary preparing for this from 1993, not a great film, but like is pretty instructive, and because a lot of it is about these people's, like, everybody from like Kris Kristofferson to Ally McGraw to like Lucien Ballard, who like shot this and like the Wild Bunch, to his longtime editors, like everybody who kind of worked with him, both of, like, James Coburn shows up, Monty Hellman shows up in this doc. But like, you can find it on YouTube, and it's about their relationship, not so much to him while working, but also off screen, because one of the themes of Peckinpah's life that you get, even as he was working, is that he would bond with these people and they would become friends off screen, like intent. He would form these intense personal relationships off screen too. Kris Kristofferson too. Like, Kris Kristofferson relays anecdotes about like Peckinpah getting so fucking drunk on the set of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, and how like they would literally at the end of like shooting days carry him to his bed and put him to bed because he was just so fucked up. But like, to me, and a lot of what they would relay to is saying that, like, this was a guy who was viewing the world through his art, but also through a lens of, like, booze, hookers, broken relationships, strained relationships with his friends and family. But, like, what you were seeing was very much, like, him and, like, made by a guy who was addicted to drinking every day.
No, and I think it completely comes through. And I think one where it really, obviously, is Wild Bunch, right? I mean, that one is...
Yeah, that's Ballad of Cable Hogue is another one, too. Like, Ballad of Cable Hogue, which many people say is, like, his favorite film. Like, Robards is almost a straight-up stand-in for Peckinpah at certain points.
Yes, yeah. And it is interesting, though, to watch a filmmaker, you know,
find their full voice. Again, that's why I love, you know, these like early films of film. And we both do.
Yeah, you know,
of like, I would even put, I'm trying to think of other examples of just like, here's a person who's like, again, like you said, more of a studio film when they don't have quite as much control.
You brought up Walter Hill. Walter Hill's actually a great example of like a guy who wrote all these movies, you know, before he basically became a director. And then he makes stuff like Hard Times and The Driver.
Yeah.
And even like Streets of Fire, which like there are infamous stories on Streets of Fire about like the battles he would have behind the scenes and stuff that would be taken away. And even like the composers of like the rock music being like
Jim Steinman stuff.
We didn't quite fucking get what he was after here. So like they're all very close.
Do you think though too, there's something about Peckinpah and these more combative filmmakers is it feels a little bit like lightning in a bottle. Because you get a movie like Wild Bunch, right? And obviously he knew what he wanted. Or Pat Garrett and Billy Kidd, which I adore that movie. Like it's one of my... especially that,
which was also butchered originally and hard to see for a long time.
But that director's cut's gorgeous.
Oh my God, yeah.
I lent you that.
The Criterion 4K. One is still on my shelf over there if you want to take it home.
I will. I'm going to watch it tomorrow. But I watched it a couple weeks, you know, months ago. But, you know, you watch that, you're like... even with all of those personal setbacks and professional setbacks, for us to still have some of the best Westerns, not best Western hotels, but the best Westerns of all time, even through that, like it almost makes you think like what would have happened, you know, it's one of those things with certain, you know, when I remember when, you know, King got sober.
Yeah.
You know, it was that whole thing of like his books suffered in some ways, you know, they're obviously you had the worst of the extremes of Cujo where it's like, I don't remember writing anything. And that book is very overwritten as much as I love it. But you're like, what would a sober Peckinpah look like? Or is this just the mix? It's just the mix that created what we got.
Yeah. I don't think that you have the worldview if you don't have the self abuse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is a weird
and
way
the self-hatred
of
maybe
it.
Too.
Self-hatred. Also, like, you know, they interview Ally McGraw in this documentary that I watched, and she talked about, and a couple other women that they interview too, is that like he had a tough time with his relationships with women. Like, you know, this is a filmmaker who has throughout the years been accused of rampant misogyny. And like you can't 100% defend it, like defend him, I should say, because like, again, this is the worldview of a guy who was clearly like a drunk womanizer who saw women as human beings. Like one of his writer's assistants, or I think somebody who might've been writing a book about him, is interviewed in this documentary. And he actually relays an anecdote about going to a whorehouse in Mexico with Peckinpah. And they sit down and they're separated by a prostitute who's basically trying to pick it up. And the guy kind of like shrugs her off and she leaves. And Peckinpah got mad at him and was basically like, how dare you look at her? She's like that. She's a human being, you know? So like he had this strange mix of like compassion, but also with this like old world masculinity that we're always at odds with one another of like this hardened, gravel-throated, cigarette-smoking man who loved women, but also like he might not have known how to actually treat them correctly.
Well, I was watching a documentary that was on the DVD for Ride the High Country. It's an interview with his sister.
Wow.
And growing
she's
up,
interviewed in this one too.
Yeah, and she's great. I mean, she's awesome. But he's like, he was a runt.
Yeah.
Like he was like the little guy of the bunch. There is a lot of Napoleon complex going on as well.
Yeah.
But it reminds me of a story. You have another actor in this, one of my favorite actors of all these films. I love Ben Johnson a lot.
Oh my God.
But there's a story from the making of, speaking of old school, again, I think he was surrounded himself with these old school men. Right. And Ben Johnson, for all accounts, was like a true gentleman, a true, like, just, you know.
He felt like a Texas sheriff, even when he was on screen.
Even off screen, you know. Yeah. And that he, there's a story from Town That Dreaded Sundown where he and the lead actor are waiting to film, and they're on the train for like a train, like, you know, off a train scene. I think the shootout through the train.
Right.
And Ben Johnson, they're just kind of talking and having a Coke or something, and they look through the window, and there's this, I think it was a PA screaming at an extra, just like opening up on her, and like, what the hell are you doing? And like Ben Johnson's like mid sentence with it's Andrew Prine, right? And he goes, 1 second. And he walks off, walks up to the guy while he's yelling at the girl, picks him up by his throat off the ground. And then he goes, if you ever talk to a lady like that in front of me again, you'll never talk again. Puts him back down, goes back on. So it's like,
goes back and picks up his Coke, you know, and starts drinking.
No, again. Seriously. It's like, but it's like you have these stories of, it made me think of Peckinpah of like, there's that mix, because there is that like weird sense of not all of that chivalrous or old school thinking, even if it's like kind, is wanted today, right? You know, it's kind of, it's gone, and it does completely connect to these films of just this era passing us by.
Which is funny because it's Peckinpah was the guy screaming, though, because like,
oh yeah.
He, in that doc, Kris Kristofferson relays an anecdote. I think it's about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, where he's sharing a scene with R.G. Armstrong.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going at it. And apparently Peckinpah, from off camera, interrupted the entire scene and started screaming, I don't believe a goddamn fucking thing that's come out of your fucking mouth, RG, and like goes off, like completely berates him to where like everybody stopped and was like, okay. Because apparently that's how Peckinpah also directed in general, like even with Ride the High Country, is the entire clan with LQ Jones and Warren Oates and everything, is that like he would isolate actors from another one another. He wouldn't let actors talk. He would only let, you know,
each team of,
exactly, yeah, like the pairs in it. Like you would have Joel McRae and
Randolph Scott.
Like they were only allowed to talk to each other. That clan that, you know, the Warren Oates and LQ Jones were made up of, they would only be able to talk to each other. Like he was known for basically creating these very combative, divisive sets that would then basically bring that tension to the screen with them. And Kristofferson ends that anecdote that he's relaying from Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And he goes, you know, Peckinpah calms down, and later the two of them talk, and he goes, you know, Peckinpah comes to him and is more or less like, well, you know, I would never talk to you like that, Chris, because like you seem like a guy who'd come across the other side of the camera and beat the shit out of me. And Kris Kristofferson simply replies with, well, you seem to be a pretty good judge of character then. That would be correct. But I mean, that's the way that he directed, like even on Straw Dogs.
Yeah.
You know, I think Kristofferson is the one who also relays this, or maybe somebody else, talking about how he would openly antagonize Dustin Hoffman. Mm. Like where he would talk about like, because Dustin Hoffman, you know, notorious method character actor, was always in character the entire time.
Everything happened on Marathon Man.
Exactly. Yeah. All the Marathon Man stuff that, like, you know, the infamous stories about him. Yeah, about him and Laurence Olivier of, like, why don't you try acting, dear boy? You know, all that stuff. Like, I guess he and Peckinpah actually got along really well because Peckinpah really fed into his method stuff and would like talk shit to him.
Like, give it to me.
On set. And basically, you know, because one of the biggest cucks in screen of all time with Straw Dogs, and that he would say shit to like Dustin Hoffman being like, are you okay with like, you know, I think your wife's out there with a limo driver right now getting fucked. Like, are you sure you're okay with that? The entire, and like really feed into this guy's sense of like this fractured, insecure masculinity that would eventually become like the ticking time bomb that is like the crux of Straw Dogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but like, if you take it back to Ride the High Country, one of the other things, you know, you initially said too, is that like, this is a movie about the end of the West. How like a lot of his best movies are, even up to my favorite film of Peckinpah's. If I were picking the one for the episode, it would be Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia.
Right.
You know, it's like very much a modern Western.
Right.
You know, but it's about the death of the West. And I think that you can actually trace his idea of how the West ends visually with the casting of this movie, with Randolph Scott and Joel McRae, these kind of icons from a bygone era of Western filmmaking, right down to like the Bud Bedeker movies that we've covered in an episode a long time ago with Randolph Scott. I mean, to where in this doc, like the one, that same writer who was talking about the whorehouse incident with Peckinpah, he had a great idea to where he was like, if you think about it, the Wild Bunch is miscast. He goes, it should have been cast more along the lines of Ride the High Country, where Ride the High Country features these two antiquated stars of like a bygone era. Like the Wild Bunch, if it was correctly cast, would have been made up of John Ford, Howard Hawks, Delmer Davies, and Raoul Walsh. Like, they would have been the actual Wild the directors. Bunch. They would have played the parts in it, because it's such a representation of, like, this is where this form of cinema ends and a new form of cinema begins.
I love that. And I love all those filmmakers.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Exactly. But, like, he's the extension of that kind of mindset, but he's moving it into a completely new era. But I mean, why did you pick Ride the High Country? Why do you think, beyond what we've kind of already discussed, like as the movie goes along, it is such like a key entry into the Peckinpah kind of body of work?
I think I'll answer it one way. I'll just say, and regardless of Peckinpah, like why this film hits me so hard is that I think as much as Wild Bunch, it hits a moment at the end of this, we're all going to die, and like, what do we hold on to in that moment?
Yeah.
Right? The sense of
fatalism.
The fatalism, but the honor, where's the, there's honor in that moment of seeing that you're probably walking out to your doom. And it's while he's such a cynical filmmaker, there's such a sentiment there too of bravery and of heroism. And regardless of whatever happened before this scene, it's all forgiven. It's all forgiven, because right now, you know, with Wild Bunch, we're going to stand for our brother, right? We're going to go out. We don't even know this guy that well, but he's one of us, right? And we're not going to leave him to die. And the same thing with this one is similar to one of my, and we'll talk about this in a later episode, it's very similar to Rio Bravo, where you have, you know, John Wayne keeping the clothes of his deputy, played by Dean Martin, dude. And he's like, oh, I've kept them. And he's like, oh, you kept these all this time? He's like, yeah, wait until they fit you again. You know, it's that thing of like, and the same, the very, very end of Ride the High Country, I think the moment that like makes this movie all come together, and then also links it to, again, a lot of his other films, is these moments between men where he says, you know, Randolph Scott says, I'm going to finish the job for you. And for context, he has betrayed his friend. He's trying to basically steal the money. He's, you know, he's a criminal. They both were at one time. And he says, I'll see it done. And Joel McRae's been gut shot. And he says, oh, I know that. You just forgot it for a little while. And I think that's the moment when I first saw this, and every time I watch it, I get teary-eyed. Seriously, every time I watch it, it's so beautiful and so real, and it just plays so hard. And then I think it links it at the same time, to answer your question, to all his stuff, is like, even in the shit of all his movies, there's this like really beautiful sense of a code of honor. Not all his movies, but like, but a lot of the West.
I mean, most of them.
But a lot of the Westerns.
Even Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is very much about this broken, washed up, crook who's given more or less an impossible task and uses it even despite all of like the tarnishing of his soul that kind of goes on as you watch that 2-hour film. Like it ends with him sort of redeeming himself or at least sort of living by a very masculine code while that white suit of his is perpetually dirtied over and over and over again to the point where like he's going to wear it while he gets gunned down to, you know, in the dirt.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a, you know, and we're recording this in a very, you know, tumultuous time in our world and a lot of uncertainty. And I think often about like, I think Peckinpah again is so great and it's so exemplified in Ride the High Country of when people are put under pressure in the moment, that's who they really are, you know?
Yeah.
And when all is lost, who are you at that moment?
Yeah. Honor under duress.
Exactly. And, you know, you even, I mean, fucking think of Lord of the Rings of, you know, they're on the side of Mount Doom and Sam's just like, well, at least we're together at the end of all things. Then he carries Frodo. It's like, it's a weird connection, but it's that, still that similar thing of just like, you have, everything's gone. You've lost absolutely everything. You still have a little bit left to give. I think it's what makes this film special, and I think it's what's special about a lot of Peckinpah's films.
How do you feel about some of his later stuff? Like, everything probably post Straw Dogs, more or less. Like, do you like Convoy? Do you like The Osterman Weekend? Do you like Killer Elite?
I like them all as curios, I think.
Sure.
I think they're not.
Convoy is probably the most popular.
Yeah, and you know I love truck stuff, and Smokey and the Bandit's one of my favorite movies, so I like all that.
Despite Alan McGraw's terrible hair.
The worst hair. But, well, wait, Straw Dogs was right before Getaway?
Yeah, it's Straw Dogs 71.
Getaway 72.
You have Getaway. We haven't even really touched upon Getaway that much, which I know you love and I'm like mixed on.
So Getaway is one of my all-time favorite movies, period, because I've mentioned it before in the podcast. I'm a huge McQueen fan, like grew up near me. I have this weird connection with him, I feel, and got really obsessed with him, especially in grad school, and like wrote a paper on him that stressed me the fuck out. But anyway, this movie, I feel, there is some honestly boring parts, I feel like, earlier on, but it has some of my favorite Peckinpah action. I think the hotel shootout.
Oh, the shotgun shootout.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you honestly watch No Country for Old Men, you're like, oh, they're doing Getaway.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's all there, you know, of those kinds of like San Antonio hotels, 2-3 stories with the long staircase.
That's also difficult to deny the chemistry between McQueen and Ally McGraw that's on screen.
That was real.
That was real. That was the movie where he stole her away from Robert Evans. Poor Robert Evans.
But that's another mean movie.
Oh, God. And Jim Thompson.
Yeah. You have, you know, him basically beating her, you know.
Beating the shit out. Well, it's one of the most emblematic. It's strange that you think about the run of movies with Alfredo Garcia, Straw Dogs, The Getaway in particular, is that they're all like almost willfully misogynistic pictures.
Oh, yeah.
Like the relationships between the men and women. I mean, Straw Dogs to the utmost degree. I don't know. I mean, you could compete probably with Alfredo Garcia's pretty bad too. But like Straw Dogs, obviously, like with the infamous rape scene where she goes from being raped to possibly enjoying it in the moment with Susan George, one of the most uncomfortable scenes you'll ever see in a movie. And also a movie that Pauline Kael straight up called, you know, a fascist film, like because she believed that it was a movie that extolled like the virtues of violence and taking the law into your own hands and killing people in the name of like vengeance. You know, Straw Dogs, I think Straw Dogs was the first Peckinpah movie I ever saw.
Oh, wow.
On that Criterion disc, I believe it was the first movie I ever of his.
Well, for me,
it
was hard to find for a long time. So, like,
my brother got that Criterion disc.
I
watched it more than we probably should have at a formative age.
I saw Wild Bunch in my dad showed it to me in middle school because I was starting to like westerns, and he's like, "This is pretty harsh, but it's still like you know, it's 60s, so it's not, you know, 90s shit." But I do think that we talk about the people that he would connect with, right? And he did two films with Steve McQueen, with Junior Bonner, and this. And this one in particular, so Steve McQueen, also a violent man toward women in real life. I mean,
yeah, not great.
He was known for Nell, his first wife.
And Jason Robards.
Yep.
Like, difficult stuff to read about with his relationships.
But yeah, I mean, McQueen was, he put a gun in his wife's mouth and, you know, he was cheating on her all the time, and his first wife, and saying, "Confess that you're cheating on me." He was a crazy person, right? And a violent man. But I do feel like Peckinpah meets these people and it's like you see a side of McQueen specifically in Getaway that's so different, because you watch 4 or 5 years earlier, you watch Bullet. And while he's a hard, quiet man in that, he's still this romantic and he's sweet and he's cute at the same time.
Well, I mean, that's very much about, like, McQueen was like one of those guys who very meticulously almost like laid out like what we now know is like the Tom Cruise playbook of
the star,
like, managing your own image and everything. Like,
oh,
he was
yeah.
very, very good at that. The Getaway is one of the few times where, like, it was given into the hands of a filmmaker, because, like, those were the two guys, and it's crazy that, like, they would make Junior Bonner together afterwards, because, you know, The Getaway, like, they were at odds the entire time, where, like, Peckinpah wanted to make one movie, and McQueen more or less, like, took the movie over because, like, he was trying to make himself look more heroic. So you wonder, again, how much of that was, like, that evil masculinity almost like seeping through like poison into the frame, because Peckinpah didn't know any other way.
Or yeah, or you're saying Peckinpah is like, "Oh, I know who you are, man.
Yeah, exactly.
I know what's underneath.
You're
this.
Me.
Yeah, like, you're
we,
me.
That's
and, like,
why we know each other."
Yeah, and not, you can't play, you know, there's other,
you can't bullshit a bullshitter.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know. So, like, have you ever seen The Osterman Weekend?
Oh yeah, years ago, but not my favorite.
It's not my favorite either, but I still think it's an interesting, as you kind of put it, curio, too. It's worth seeking out. I don't even know how available it is anymore. There might be a Kino Lorber, like, indicator probably, disc, I want to say. But I remember, I mean, your version of grad school was me, or my version of your grad school was me starting work at Vulcan Video back in the day, and two of the main auteurs that I went through and used the director's wall to basically fill all the holes of, like, the stuff I'd never seen before were Peckinpah and Walter Hill.
Yeah.
And I worked my way through both of their filmographies almost like simultaneously. It would almost trade off one for the other while I was watching them. And, like, I remember seeing all that stuff, like, and getting to Osterman Weekend, and, like, Osterman is like, he had already basically drank himself to death at this point. It's debatable how much of that movie he even really directed.
Yeah.
I mean, Convoy's the same way.
Oh yeah.
Convoy infamously, like, I guess Coburn was, like, credited, I think, as an assistant director or something, because he was trying to get his DGA membership at the time, and he more or less directed huge chunks of that movie in secret because Peckinpah was so fucking drunk that they would carry him off set, and then Coburn would basically manage the set for the rest of the day.
Well, it's weird when you hear the stories about, beyond the horrible shit he's done, Bryan Singer, you know,
yeah,
the same thing, that, like, he wasn't there to direct a lot of the movies he quote unquote
directed.
Like, Simon Kinberg, I guess, directed the majority of the later X-Men movies.
Yeah, huge chunks.
He just wouldn't show up.
So did Dexter Fletcher.
Yeah.
They said would directed huge chunks of the Queen movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like,
oh yeah,
that's why it looks so fucking weird at certain points, is because, like, Bryan Singer was such a baby bitch boy that he would leave the set every day and just let somebody else direct. Now, Peckinpah, not so much a baby bitch boy. Don't think we could ever accuse him of being that.
Quite
he
the
would
opposite.
Punch you straight in the face if you did that. But he was just drunk. He was a notorious alcoholic, and you know, he kind of paid the price for it because he dies in 1984, like right after the Osterman weekend.
In his 50s.
I want to say 55? Yeah, 59 sounds right.
Yeah. 57, 59,
But I mean, it's bad.
Yeah.
So like way too young to die, and also like may have denied us a couple more movies in the process.
Yeah. Yeah, and he, I mean, but in his prime... again, like talking about, you know, stuff that you and I just shit for, like male codes. I mean, it's like Michael Mann, Walter Hill. It's all there. It's just,
it's all that hardcore, two-fisted, masculine filmmaking that we just get totally hard for.
Always. So, always.
Now, I mean, in his prime, and we'll get to questions after this, is that like his alcoholism did lead to one of the funniest test screening anecdotes of all time, is that what I think it's Major Dundee is taken away from him by the studio and cut behind his back. The executive summoned him to a screening that they all had together to show him their cut of the movie. And he was so drunk and so fucking angry that he literally went upstage and pissed on the screen in front of them, which like, if there's anything that's going to make you one of my heroes for the rest of my life, like it's a story like that, man. Like a guy who's just like, fuck you so much and just pisses on the screen.
Yeah. Now we have Marvel where it's just like, hey, how can I,
your name is on this, but like the producers fucking direct these movies. You want to get to questions?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Come from just the other side of nowhere to this big time lonesome town. They got a lot of ice and snow here, half as cold as all the people I've found. Every way I've tried to go here seemed to bring me down. Seen about enough to know where I belong. I've got a mind to see the headlights shining on that old white line between my heart and home. Sick of spending Sundays wishing they would Mondays. Setting in a park.
And we're back with questions about 1962's Ride the High Country, Martin. Top five Sam Peckinpah movies. We're doing a straight up traditional question segment. Go.
I'm going to go number five, Straw Dogs. This is a tough one.
It really is.
Because like, they're all like high up there.
I don't know if they all are. I think there's like a cutoff point.
There's like seven.
Right at Convoy.
Yeah. So I would
say. And you even really like Convoy.
I do. But I would say Straw Dogs, number five. And then I would do Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia as four, which I also love.
Seems low, but okay.
And then I'm going to do, while it was the pick for today, Ride the High Country. It's not my favorite Peckinpah. I just think it's interesting. And then honestly, one and two flip between Wild Bunch and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. I think Wild Bunch is the clear, like just classic, you know, it's just like, it's a action-packed, amazing, like it's the better film.
I think if we're being honest, like there's a clear, like objective number one. It's Wild Bunch.
Yeah, agreed.
Like we can say others are our favorites or whatever, or what we prefer, but like there's the Wild Bunch and there's everything else.
Right. I think though Pat Garrett is a favorite of mine because it has some scenes. And I think it's one of the things about Peckinpah that's so interesting, just great, is that sometimes in a scene level, he's untouchable.
Yeah.
And the moment for me and Pat Garrett, Billy Kid, is the death of Slim Pickens. And you have Knocking on Heaven's Door playing while he's been shot.
God.
And his wife's looking at him. And he's slowly dying. And the fucking mountains are behind. First time I saw that, I was just like bawling my eyes out. I was like, why?
That song Rises.
And you're just like, what the? Where is this coming from? Like, and then
the end, it very much in a kind of similar vein as, actually, I'm not going to say it. It's similar to another film that I might talk about as a double feature.
They talk in that documentary I keep referencing, Sam Peckinpah, Man of Iron, about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and James Coburn and Kris Kristofferson. They actually, it's one of the best parts of the doc is they cross cut the interviews they do with them and they talk about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And they say the main scene that sold them on making the movie is the raft scene where the guy's floating down the river on the raft and James, and he's shooting bottles and James Coburn sees him and he takes a shot at him. And he takes a shot back at Coburn and he kind of keeps going as they like stare each other down. Apparently that's the scene that made them want to make the movie.
Interesting.
Together, because they said it was like a microcosm of the entire attitude of the picture. And then, but the studio, this is the crazy part, is the studio wanted the scene cut and didn't give them the money to make that scene in the movie. So they all went in secret with the crew. Nobody got paid for a day. And they filmed the scene together so they would be in the movie because everybody was so wildly in love with it and found it to be so poetic and like this one moment kind of representation of like the greater idea of the whole.
Yeah, I love that. I didn't know that story because, and that is another side of Peckinpah too, is, you know, among the gruffness, there's, it's, he's such a romantic. Like,
yeah.
Oh my God. Like,
he's a very lyrical guy.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And, you know, one of our mutual favorite filmmakers is John Woo, and he constantly says,
Peckinpah's the dude.
Peckinpah and Melville are my two, like, you know, the killer is
Peckinpah. I mean, makes so total sense when you watch The Wild Bunch and you think about John Woo watching The Wild Bunch and being like, oh, yeah, this is my thing now.
Yeah. Yeah. And just the squibs and everything. And just, you know,
the slow motion.
Yeah. Slow motion and fast motion and all that shit.
I'm going to go the other way. In terms of ranking, I'm going to go number one is Alfredo Garcia. I think it's just like the untouchable masterpiece that I go back to time and again. It's also the most Jacob pick of all time.
What a dreary movie.
A dreary, nihilistic dirge of a film that has no hope and no light at the end of the tunnel. So, of course, it's my favorite. Two would be Straw Dogs. And Straw Dogs was such a formative movie for me, despite it being so ugly. It was kind of in... That's the thing about Peckinpah, is that Peckinpah, I came to his more lyrical films later and found the poeticism and stuff like Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid and even The Wild Bunch and stuff like that. That came later. I was more attracted... as I was into the more extreme kind of sides of cinema and exploring, because it was the same time where I was like renting Blue Velvet at the video store and seeking out like bootlegs of Cannibal Holocaust and like trying to find like the most extreme shit that people wrote about in books and stuff. Like Peckinpah fit into that mold. So I wanted to see Straw Dogs. I wanted to see Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia because they were touted as such like notorious fucked up movies.
Yeah.
And Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, honestly, even to the people who made it, they said it's like the most complete Peckinpah movie, like the one that kind of somehow through a miracle of like God made it through the system completely unscathed and like as he originally envisioned it with no kind of like notes or touches or anything.
Undistilled.
Yeah.
Distilled. Yeah.
Yeah. Completely. Yeah. Yeah. It's like uncut, pure Peckinpah. Three, I mean, is Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much more you can say about that movie. It's one of the defining American masterpieces of cinema. Four would probably be Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Five would be, definitely Ride the High Country. Like, you know, these are the main ones. And I really like some of the curios. I mean, I don't like Killer Elite, but like, I think all of his movies have moments within them where you're like, what?
Well, the whole betrayal between Robert Duvall and James Caan is good. The whole thing where he shoots him, like, there's some good scenes.
And then there's fucking ninjas.
No, shit's insane.
Yeah, completely insane film. I still like parts of The Osterman Weekend because, as I was saying to you kind of off mic, and maybe I should save this for a remake, but I'm just going to do this now, is that, like, I swear the Osterman Weekend has one of the best setups of any movie of all time. It's just he was so fucking drunk and the studio interfered so much that, like, you know, you don't really get a great version of it, but it's literally about, like, the big chill. But what if you found out that your old college buddies were, like, Soviet spies and you were all playing, like, an Agatha Christie game of, like, murdering one another? That sounds fucking awesome. Like, if
you, Hateful Eight.
Yeah, if you redid that movie, like, it would be, it would be monumental if you did it the right way. You know, Convoy, I still think Convoy kind of sucks. Like, I know a lot of people have some affection for it. You have some affection for it. The music's great.
Yeah.
I'll give you that much. The theme song is fucking amazing. And it's in that weird time period where, like, CBs and big rigs stuff.
Smokey the Bandit era.
Were, like, huge. But, like, I just don't think that movie's very good. Yeah,
I don't watch it a lot.
No, but some people love it.
Yep.
Oh, a guy who owned one of the restaurants I worked for a long time, that was his favorite movie of all time. He loved fucking Convoy.
Okay.
Like, exactly. And you were just like, sure.
Convoy.
Exactly. Like, he literally could sing. He could sing the fucking song.
Everyone knows.
And he
that
did. Like, when we started talking about movies, because I got him to watch Rolling Thunder, and he loved that. And I was like, oh, this would seem up your alley.
Talk about a Peckinpah movie.
Yeah. As soon as I found out that he was like, Convoy is my favorite movie, I'm like, that's a very strange pull, but okay, sure. So, double feature.
My first thing popped in my head would have been Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid with Assassination of Jesse James. Of just like, I love that movie a lot. And talk about another film that was interfered with by the studio in a lot of ways, but you have the guilt of killing a legend, you know, and everything that comes with that. The main difference being you, like, Robert Ford is shown to be this kind of sniveling worm, you know, through a lot of the film, versus there's an honor to Pat Garrett of, oh my God, that I had to do this. You have that theme of, again, civilization is moving on, and now we're on opposite sides of the law. And I have to kill you for my own purposes. But the other one I was thinking of to go with Ride the High Country is Day of the Outlaw, which is a Andre de Toth movie.
Yeah, good movie.
You got Robert Ryan.
I want to talk about a mean filmmaker.
That's the thing. You have Burl Ives as the bad guy. Burl Ives.
Burl Ives.
I mean, who's not known for playing villains, you know, like Mr. Christmas. And it is this really, it's a black and white, it's a winter western, and Burl Ives and his soldiers come in, and they're just like, they just want to, like, fuck up the town. And he's like, if you let us stay and let us basically take your women, we'll let everybody live. And it is a really, the reason I put it with Ride the High Country is it, for its era, was, I feel, unique. And then it had this undercurrent of, like, whoa, this is not a, like, programmer, normal black and white programmer of this time. There's some shit on its mind. It also has one of the best sequences I've ever seen in a Western, which is the showdown in the snow. And it's a highly recommended movie. I love it, absolutely.
So I was just going to go with the very obvious route, especially considering this podcast, is that, and maybe you can help me kind of thought exercise this out, is that I'm down between two pairings with Ride the High Country. Is you do Ride the High Country with either Seven Men from Now or The Tall T.
Yeah, Baedeker, which we were talking about when we did the Baedeker episode.
Like, it's they're so obvious. I might lean more towards Tall T because the Elmore Leonard connection would make it kind of even deeper. But I mean, you have Seven Men from Now that also has Lee Marvin in it, and it's like, it would just pair so well with Ride the High Country that they're kind of undeniable. And I also feel like if you actually did it at a true, like, 35 millimeter screening, you know, at a drive-in or whatever, you could actually put Seven Men from Now or The Tall T as, like, the second B picture as part of the double bill as they were originally intended.
Yeah. I mean, I would absolutely. And they're similarly pressure cooker movies. And,
right.
And like the setup, you have a very similar setup of you have the good old gun now in this played by Joel McRae. You have the kind of schemer played by Randolph Scott. And you have Heck, the character who's the younger boy, who's kind of drawn between them of like, what's he going to be like when he grows up? Like he has his boss, his kind of, which is Randolph Scott, who's like, hey, we're going to rob from him. And it's him between. And the same thing happens in the majority of the Bedecker films. You have a younger character who's kind of on the line of, who am I going to side with here? And
well, thinking about it, Tall T might be a better pairing just because the homoeroticism.
Oh, yeah.
That boils within it. And also Henry Silva.
Chink.
Is playing Chink.
Yeah.
That might
that's,
be the
that's
better
his character
pairing.
Name for the yeah. record. It's his character name.
So, like, that actually might fit better. I think I might go with Tall T instead. But either way, you know.
Also, it's a that's great a banger of a double feature.
And it's also easier because, like, you know, Ride the High Country is like 93 minutes long, and then either of the Bedecker films is like 75 minutes long.
at the longest.
So you're just in and out, really crushing tape that night.
Yes.
So remake, redo, prestige series, Ride the High Country. What do you think?
I think for like Ride the High Country, I don't know what to do with it. I think that I love it, but I love that it's a product of its time as it is, as this 90-minute thing.
Yeah.
I
don't think you can redo that movie specifically. I have an idea for, like, a limited series I think would be cool, but, like, but yeah.
I think, like, The Getaway would actually translate well to TV. I think a longer...
You could also do a more faithful adaptation of the Thompson book.
Yeah, but you get, like, two, like... You get an HBO series, 6-8 episode.
I mean, we already mentioned redoing the Osterman Weekend would be a great premise for a movie.
Yeah, honestly, they remade Killer Elite, which was even worse than the original.
Somehow.
It's so bad.
With De Niro.
It's
and
so
Clive
bad.
Owen.
And Jason Statham.
It's horrible.
There's a scene in that movie where I was like, I want to jump out the window. Where
And then I did.
And they said, we call ourselves the Feathermen. I'm like, okay. They're like, because our touch is so light. I'm like, no, I get it. I hate that movie so fucking much.
And then it stays him in the background, went, gay!
I know, that movie's so fucking stupid. But I'm trying to think of other... Honestly, Straw Dogs might make a good series as like a slower burn, like 4 episode. But that'd be fucked up.
So hear out my galaxy brain pitch to you. What if you made a movie... And I'm thinking about, and we can kind of workshop this together, but like perhaps you do it almost in like, the way I'm thinking about it, it's almost like a 4-chapter behind the scenes drama, kind of the same way you remember Steve Jobs. I guess Danny yeah. Boyle's really on my brain lately because of 28 Years Later and
which
thinking
is great.
About his filmography. It's an absolute masterpiece. But I've been thinking about Steve Jobs because I've been thinking about, you know, my favorite Danny Boyle films. And I've always thought Steve Jobs was an undervalued entry in his filmography because I love the structure of it that Alex Ross Perry also uses for her smell, too. To a certain degree, is that it's all very segmented and presented in acts and these behind the scenes acts where like Steve Jobs, it's all behind the scenes right before a major product launch in Apple's history. In Her Smell, it's all concert behind the scenes as Elizabeth Moss's character melts down, you know, before a specific performance with her girl, her Riot Girl kind of punk band. And I was thinking about what if you did a limited series or even movie or mini series that takes place, this would probably work more as just a feature, is that you have 4 acts, but it's exploring Peckinpah, the man behind 4 of the most tumultuous, you know, productions of his career. Is that you do, one is like, you know, Major Dundee, where he ends up pissing on the screen. You know, another is Straw Dogs, where he's fighting with everybody the whole time in England, trying to make this incredibly brutal, you know, Siege picture. One is Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, where he's behind the scenes, like really trying to make this very poetic Western. And maybe the last is something like Convoy or whatever, where you get to the end of his life where he's literally getting carried off the set because he's so drunk and so basically over it, even as he continues to make movies. But like, you make this portrait of this very tortured artist through his numerous battles with the studios and with producers and everything. And it's like this guy who, like, we knew in the end had genius in him and would be eventually vindicated by time. You know, it's like, I saw that another Alex Ross movie, Perry movie recently, Pavement, his kind of weird experimental documentary about the 90s rock band Pavement, or alternative band, I guess you would consider it. And Stephen Malkmus is, you know, quoted in it, and I'm going to butcher the quote, but he basically says, like, you know, I always considered myself as a guy who made music for the future, but, like, I guess every artist who doesn't think of himself as being appreciated in his time thinks that he's making music for the future. And, like, I always feel like that's how Peckinpah was, is, like, this guy who was totally ahead of the curve and kind of knew he was ahead of the curve and was making this very controlled, demanding art, but, like, ended up being defined as much by his struggles with both alcohol and Final Cut and the studios and, like, having movies taken away from him as he was by, like, the stuff we would eventually come to see as, like, true masterpieces.
Yeah, I love the idea, because we talked about this with the Bedeker episode. We had the kind of thing we came together of the big fish thing, of, because Bedeker was known for telling these tall tales, right? Which I still think is a great idea.
Great idea for a movie.
Yeah, and I would love to write that with you and watch it. But I think with this one, I think you'd have to have at least the first segment a film where it went well, right? You'd have to have a little bit of an arc of what was he like. What was he like?
Would that be Ride the High Country?
I think it might be. I don't know.
He just delivers the movie, because from all accounts, it sounds like he just made the movie.
Yeah, and you think about where it happened, but then you think about, in a similar vein, in a weird way, I always think of movies like Whiplash, where it's like the price of genius, the price of,
right,
of artistic reaching.
And that's sort of what I'm getting at, yeah, too, with the pitch, too, of like this guy who maybe his drinking was even exacerbated by the fact that, like, all of these calamities kept happening to his art.
But at the same time, like, do we get the movies that we love without that part, right? It's like, do we separate...
The
ugliness, or whatever we want to call
that's
it.
That's the true drama of,
yeah,
it. Is that it's like...
That's the question.
It really is, like, painting... Almost like painting Sam Peckinpah in the same palette or light as what his actual protagonists were by the guy himself, is like at his core, or at our movie's core, our series core, is that it's about a guy who, like, was constantly at war with everyone. But in the end, that's what resulted in what we actually get on screen.
Well, I love that, because you also think about, I didn't even think about it when we're talking about Wild Bunch, but, like, famously, William Holden's character, he's like, I just did Peckinpah. He's like, it was just Peckinpah impersonation, yeah, famously. Is that what if you really go, if you want to go even crazier with it, is do, you know, I'm Not There, and have different actors play Peckinpah at different parts of his life.
Well, hear me out. You know, I actually had a person in my head, because I looked at pictures of them side by side and thought about him playing Peckinpah, and was like, I now cannot, if we ever made this movie, could not make it with anybody else. If you did Michael Shannon as Peckinpah,
ooh,
had him get back with to that, like, crazy his energy, gaunt,
yeah,
wild-eyed.
Take Shelter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, think about it.
I mean, I think that's a great... I think it would, like you said, a film, but I think also a, like, 4-part miniseries would be really interesting of, like,
yeah,
you pop really esoteric, like, style film too. And, like, I don't even know who you'd have to hire an amazing, I'm almost thinking of, like, a movie like
The Strangeness of Mishima, you know?
Of
like, but also mixing in.
I like your idea of I'm Not There, though, of having multiple actors play him throughout, you know, time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you could get as a producer and be like, you know, Tarantino's obviously a monster fan. These people who's he's inspired, you know, at least come on as like creative consultants, like, hey, or have different directors for each segment. Go all the way with it, you know, of all these people that he's touched with his style. John Hillcoat can do an episode, you know. I just think, like, you could go big with it.
Hell, even have, you know what would be the ultimate? Have Tarantino play him.
Oh, yeah.
In one of the segments.
Done. I mean, seriously, just go. Because
think about the publicity you would get for that. Like, that would get people tuning in or buying a ticket just out of morbid curiosity alone. Because even if Tarantino's horrible, people are going to talk about it.
Yep. Yep.
But he'll probably be horrible. Let's be real. Yeah, he's not a good actor.
He's not a good actor. But you have. Because there is a ridiculousness to all what we're talking about.
Exactly.
You know, and you got to go. Because also, you don't want it to be a drudgery movie, right? You want it to be kind of.
No, but crazy. That's why I also referenced Steve Jobs, is that Steve Jobs, in lesser hands, if it wasn't Boyle and it wasn't Sorkin, you know, Boyle directing and Sorkin writing, you would have a pretty standard, you know, hero worship biopic, which, I mean, it is the one kind of criticism of Steve Jobs you can level, is that, like, by the end, when, you know, the whole, like, very syrupy, I'm going to put music in your pocket scene with, you know, Fassbender and his daughter at the end, which a scene I love to death. Despite, it's one of the great moments of, like, me recognizing a thing is not good and still being moved by it and being like, I don't fucking care, because, like, Boyle's such a, like, staunch humanist and, like, is in love with people and the way they connect in a way that it's still, like, it makes me, like, tear up even, like, thinking about it. But, like, you have, you know, sort of, like, this very heightened, chaotic, tumultuous kind of ridiculousness. Like, you almost have to do each one as sort of like a bottle episode.
Yeah.
Which might lead to, like, a Tarantino directing it, to where, like, imagine Tarantino directing the Straw Dogs episode, but doing it in the style of, like, Hateful Eight.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, stuff like that.
And, yeah, and just the sense of
Jeremy Saulnier coming and see, look at your face, coming on and doing, like, imagine Saulnier doing, like, the Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid behind the scenes stuff.
Ooh, that'd be great.
Like, about, and, like, finding the lyricism and violence and everything.
And Andrew Dominik coming up for one.
Andrew Dominik doing, you know, like, even, I mean, Fincher would just want to direct the whole fucking thing, so you can't really do him. But, like, yeah, guys like that.
Who he's, you know, man, and, like, if you have a lot, you have more episodes, like, fucking John Woo comes in and does Wild Bunch, and it's just, like, insane behind the scenes.
But he,
like,
directs Wild. Imagine the, like, you do a scene about the making of the end of Wild Bunch, but then John Woo puts his, like, signature, like, slow motion on it, too. So it's, like, him reinterpreting Wild Bunch through the lens of John Woo. Tell me how you wouldn't sign up for that shit.
Yeah, that's just, like, film nerd porn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It just feels like a thing that's, like, we're in an era where we keep exploring. Like, I always come back to, what was that miniseries with Miles Teller?
Oh, the
Offer.
The Offer, yeah.
You know, where, to bring up Robert Evans again, Matthew Good as Robert Evans in that was fucking incredible.
Great, yeah.
But, like, we're in the era of, like, making these miniseries and movies about, you know, Saturday Night is another thing about the first episode of Saturday Night Live, of making these movies that kind of romanticize the creation of our favorites from these certain eras. And, like, I just feel like Peckinpah is such untapped territory, to where, like, for all the reasons we've kind of already outlined, is that, like, the drama's all there.
Oh, my God.
Like, it's baked into the man
himself. It's not Bohemian Rhapsody, you have to make it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like,
you literally, you could look at the Wikipedia pages. yeah. for shit like Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid or Major Dundee and be like, Jesus, this guy did all of this and this happened to him? Like, you, the script writes itself at that point.
Yeah, it would never lack for drama.
All right, so last question. Face Melter. Yay, nay.
To Ride the High Country?
Yeah.
No.
It's not. Let's expand. Is there a Face Melter inside of the Peckinpah body of work?
Yeah.
Which one?
Wild Bunch.
I think Wild Bunch?
100%.
I think Straw Dogs, too, well, makes the argument.
That's shocking as fuck.
That's more, yeah.
I just showed my partner Antichrist. A very similar mentality of like, oh.
Psychotic behavior on your point, by the way. I would like to point out to the audience.
Big mistake.
If you are in a committed relationship, looking to get married, whatever, if you just willingly are like, hey, for movie night this week, what would you think about Lars von Trier's Antichrist? Take a second. And don't do that. You told me the story at the bar, and I had told you a story before that was completely psychotic. And then you were like, oh, yeah, by the way, I showed my girlfriend Antichrist. And I went, well, you just beat me.
She enjoyed it, but it was one of those things where, like, well, good night.
Yeah, I was going to say, the story ends with your partner literally getting up from the couch and going, I'm going to bed. I don't care if you join me. I'm going to bed, though.
That's the power of Lars. You got to sleep on it. And I think it's the experience we all have when we watch that movie.
You got to sleep with it at that point.
You just got to be like, well.
I just like that you told the detail that we're also leaving out is that you said you went to bed later that night. And she just back turned to you like, don't touch me. Thinking about babies falling out of windows.
That's a fucked up movie.
Female castration.
Oh, God.
You know, talk about a misogynistic movie.
Oh, Jesus, man. You know, oh, fuck.
You know, maybe we should do a Lars von Trier episode.
I'm in.
Really? No hesitation.
Yes, when do I sign up?
I mean, rewatching it.
The House That Jack Built, rewatchable. Just fucking go, baby.
Let's just watch Dancer in the Dark for a real good time.
Oh, my God. Were the Dogma 95 movies that he made, the Nicole Kidman?
Manderley, Dogville.
Manderley, Dogville. God, the America trilogy, they called it, right? Is that it's just real brutal, brutal shit.
Yes.
I don't know. Well, Melancholia, great time at the movies. Always feeling good after that one.
Yep.
Well, Martin, this is not an episode to plan things that are going to basically be used in Guantanamo Bay and future torture sessions. This is a wrap up of our Sam Peckinpah episode. And I got to be honest, went pretty well.
Absolutely.
And we do have more kind of, it's crazy is that we've been talking about doing these one-offs where we just do like one movie and kind of shorten it and not do like a whole director's filmography. But like, we just wound up on this one and we're like, guess what? You're getting all of it at once.
Well, it's hard when you have a director like this. Like, yeah. You can't keep it in a bottle. Like, you know, it just...
Exactly.
It's so... And it's a filmmaker that we both like... We're like, well, duh.
And again, who's you just know? Defined by drama within the behind the scenes as much as it is by what's on screen. It's just you could talk. We've only recorded for 85 minutes and we could literally talk for probably hours after it. But... We do have more coming from you. We've got a Howard Hawks episode coming soon.
More Westerns.
We've got a Darkman episode coming soon. We've got a William Friedkin episode coming soon. Like a whole lot of shit.
Alan Parker down the pipe.
Some Alan Parker down the pipeline. Maybe some Killer Animals. Some William Girdler. Some Jaws knockoffs. Mm-hmm. Well, you have to stay tuned to Secret Handshake to see what's up next. Bye.
Bye.